Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jessa Bonner of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who assesses the full text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, revealing a free trade agreement that advances corporate rights. Climate activist Tim DeChristopher, who talks about the danger of false optimism in the difficult struggle ahead combating climate change. And Kaylin Jordan, co-founder of UncokeMyCampus.org, who discusses her group's work to expose and challenge the Koch brothers' funding of hundreds of colleges and universities across the U.S. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a blow against the war on drugs, Mexico's Supreme Court ruled it is legal for individuals to grow or consume marijuana for personal use. While the case did not overturn Mexico's harsh drug laws, the ruling opened a path to eventual legalization of pot in the nation which is the main exporter of marijuana to the U.S. Several Latin American nations in recent years have moved to decriminalize various classes of drugs. 2 years ago, Uruguay moved to legalize marijuana, Chile has recently harvested its first crop of medical marijuana, and Colombia's President Juan Manuel Santos has halted the aerial spraying of illegal coca fields. In 2009, Mexico decriminalized possession of small amounts of marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. But many Mexicans, including the nation's president, Eugene Peña Nieto, continue to oppose the legalization of cannabis, fearing that it would open the door to increased drug use. Drug reform advocates insist legalization will undermine the power of the drug cartels and reduce the levels of violence associated with the war on drugs, which has caused the deaths of 100,000 Mexicans over the last decade. Voters in Maine reaffirmed their support for public financing of state elections, overcoming the opposition of Tea Party Governor Paul LePage and the Maine Chamber of Commerce. The Maine Clean Elections Initiative will boost the amount of taxpayer funds given to qualified candidates in state elections and boost transparency of campaign spending. Maine's clean election system was first approved by voters in 1996 and proved popular with many candidates. Yet the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United decision and another in an Arizona case left Clean Election Act candidates vulnerable to big spending by privately funded opponents. In 2014, independent groups spent $14 million to influence Maine elections, an amount greater than that spent by the candidates themselves. Under a new formula approved by 55% of Maine voters, candidates for governor will be eligible for $3.2 million in public financing, candidates for state senate can receive $65,000, and those in state house races, $16,500. Nationally, campaign reform advocates praised recent ballot initiative victories in Maine and in cities including Seattle and San Francisco as opening a new chapter on limiting the power of money in politics. Josh Silver of the group Represent U.S. asserted, "Local grassroots victories are how we fix our corrupt political system. We are fighting for a future where political outcomes are decided by the best ideas, not by the biggest bank account." On the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton is promoting reform of gun laws as a core election issue for Democrats. This is in contrast to 2008, when Clinton was largely silent on the issue of gun violence. The former Secretary of State ramped up her rhetoric on the issue after the June massacre of 9 parishioners at an African-American church by a white separatist in Charleston, South Carolina. During a recent campaign event in Iowa, Clinton called out the National Rifle Association and pledged to make gun control a, quote, voting issue that motivates Democrats in the same way gun rights motivates Republicans to vote. By focusing on gun safety, Clinton has put progressive U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders on the defensive. Vermont has some of the weakest gun laws in the country, and during the 1990s, Sanders voted against the Brady Bill, which required mandatory background checks for gun buyers. The third Democrat in the race, former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, has pledged to issue 7 executive orders to reduce gun violence if elected next year. In recent months, Hillary Clinton has also proposed major criminal justice reforms, including her endorsement of the movement to ban the box, which would prohibit federal contractors from asking job applicants about their criminal records during initial screenings. Still, Clinton faced a vocal protest in Atlanta from Black Lives Matter activists who disrupted her speech at the historically black Clark Atlanta University. The moment was emblematic of how criminal justice reform has emerged as a pivotal issue in the 2016 presidential race. Clinton opponents Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley both contrasted their support for abolishing the death penalty with Clinton, who wants to retain the use of capital punishment in certain egregious cases. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
On November 5th, the Obama administration released the full text of the proposed 12-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. The controversial pact, which will cover trade rules integrating 40% of the world's economy, must now be voted on by the U.S. Congress. With the release of the full text of the agreement, Congress now has 90 days to review the TPP before President Obama can ask for an up or down vote under the terms of fast-track legislation approved in June. Opponents of the trade deal, including a broad coalition of labor, environmental, and consumer groups, assert that the actual elements of the agreement, now made public, are worse than originally feared. They cite an extension of intellectual property rights in the pact that will increase the cost and reduce access to critical life-saving drugs, the offshoring of thousands of U.S. manufacturing jobs to cheaper labor markets, and the flooding of the U.S. with unsafe and unlabeled imported food. Another divisive provision of the TPP, the Investor State Dispute Settlement, or ISDS, allows multinational corporations to challenge local, state, and federal public health, environmental, consumer, and labor laws, as well as court rulings, if a claim is made that they impinge on business profits. Your reporter spoke with Jessa Bonner, International Program Associate with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who summarizes the full text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which she and other opponents believe advances corporate rights at the expense of citizens' rights.
The TPP is requiring new marketing exclusivities and patent term extensions, which is going to harm access to medicine. These new what is known as marketing and data exclusivity rules actually delay generic drug registration for a specific period of time. And so we see that these terms in the TPP are going to contribute to what could be preventable suffering and death. And also one of the most controversial parts of this is the issue of access to biologic medicines, which are medicines that are used by patients that are fighting cancer, among some other diseases. And so we saw that at the behest of big pharmaceutical companies in the U.S., that the U.S. was really pushing this really extreme agenda in terms of the monopoly patent terms for these biologic medicines. And though while the countries did not give in to what the U.S. was pushing, which was an automatic monopoly term that was longer than 5 years, actually up to 12 years at one point, USCR insisted on including some text that actually allows the U.S. government to pressure and pull countries towards a longer period. So it's kind of undefined between 5 and 8 years, but it goes beyond this five-year period. And another issue, an e-commerce chapter that actually undermines consumer privacy protections for sensitive personal, health, financial, and other data when it crosses borders by basically exposing these policies to challenges as a violation of TPP's limit on regulation and data flows. So this includes rules that could require countries to allow unregulated cross-border transfer of internet users' data and prohibit governments from requiring companies to host data on local servers. So that's another major issue related to intellectual property in the TPP.
Jessa, I wanted to ask you about food safety and inspections and GMO crops, which all are dealt with in the TPP text that we now have. Can you tell us about that?
So one thing that we're seeing in the TPP is that it's going to require the U.S. to import seafood, meat, and poultry that doesn't necessarily comply with our safety standards. So basically that means that Under the TPP, the U.S. would be required to allow food imports if the exporting country's safety regime is deemed as what's known as equivalent to our own, even if it's not the same or maybe it violates our food safety laws. There will be a big increase in imports, but not necessarily an increase of inspection at the border. So right now, in terms of some of the seafood that's coming into our country, the FDA is really only inspecting about 1% of it and finding issues in that 1%. This means there's going to be just a major increase. Another big concern, as you mentioned, is the issue of labeling of food, labeling things as GMO, free, etc. So under the TPP, these food labels could potentially be challenged as a trade barrier. And this is something that's happened in the past. We've seen this happen in other trade venues, such as a very popular provision, which is known of country of origin labeling, which basically requires for consumers to know what country their meat is coming from, which seems to make a lot of sense, especially if, you know, there's concerns there could potentially be temporary outbreak of some kind of disease, et cetera. You might want to know to make sure that, you know, for that time being, to not be choosing meat from that particular area. But that was actually upheld at the WTO as a trade violation. So there's a big concern about the implications of the safety of our food in the TPP.
What's the timeline for a vote in Congress on this free trade treaty? And maybe you could describe for us the coalition of groups that are working to defeat it when that vote actually comes up.
I mean, now that we've seen what's in the text, and we've known that there are a lot of really concerning things, but now that we can see, you know, that the things that were ultimately negotiated are worse than we could have expected, it's only going to kind of increase the amount of opposition to this deal. So Obama did actually last week give his notice of intent to sign to Congress. So that starts kind of a 90-day clock from when Congress could conceivably vote on the TPP, but we're still seeing a lot of opposition in Congress. Some of the biggest proponents of this agreement are saying they don't think there's going to be a vote in 2016. We have an election coming up, so it's really kind of unclear that this is going to be something that's going to be able to get through Congress anytime soon. I mean, there were many members of Congress that said they would support the TPP if, at a minimum, it included these past reforms that were made, as I mentioned, to intellectual property rules for access to medicine, as well as the environment. But what we've seen is that the TPP has actually been a rollback of these things. So that's going to cost some support of some members. And as you mentioned, there's an unprecedented number and wide array of organizations that are opposing any attempt to push the TPP through Congress. And this is really kind of a wider coalition than we've seen working on these kinds of deals before. We're talking about all major labor unions, environmental groups, faith groups, human rights groups, consumer groups, groups that are working on internet freedom, etc. So what's really important is that we need to just make sure, especially now that we have seen the text and we know exactly what's in it and that it's going to be very harmful, that we're calling up our members of Congress, writing to them, tweeting at them, et cetera, and asking them to oppose the TPP, because the TPP can't become a reality if it can't get through Congress.
That was Jessa Bonner, International Program Associate with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. For more news and commentary on the campaign to defeat the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement in Congress, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Climate activist Tim DeChristopher gained notoriety across the country when he served almost 2 years in prison for a nonviolent act of civil disobedience in 2008 by making false bids for gas and oil development leases. After his release from a federal prison, he enrolled at Harvard Divinity School with the goal of becoming a Unitarian minister. He's now taken a year's leave of absence to co-found the Climate Disobedience Center, which aims to provide support to activists who risk serious consequences for engaging in direct action to combat the causes of climate change. DeChristopher was a keynote speaker at the 3rd Annual Climate Stewardship Summit, held November 5th in West Hartford, Connecticut, organized by the Interreligious Eco-Justice Network, the Connecticut affiliate of the faith-based national organization Interfaith Power and Light. DeChristopher began his talk by giving examples of both good and bad news in the previous week. He mentioned the Obama administration's denial of TransCanada's request to put their bid to build the Keystone XL pipeline on hold, Obama went on to reject the permit to build the pipeline the day after the conference concluded. He also cited a bill introduced by 7 members of Congress, including presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, to keep all fossil fuels under public lands and waters in the ground. The bad news, DeChristopher mentioned, included China's admission that it had underestimated its carbon emissions from coal-burning power plants by 17%, or 1 billion tons a year of additional CO2, the planet's most damaging greenhouse gas. A portion of his talk, excerpted here, focused on the difference between hope and optimism, especially the false optimism he says many environmental groups project out of fear that people can't handle the truth about the serious challenges we face on combating climate change.
So we're holding these two extremes, this extreme paradox here, between so much positive progress and so much new opportunities in the expansion of the possible, and so much bad news. It seems to be closing down so many possibilities of actually preventing a significant collapse of our civilization. And so I think it's worth asking, how do we deal with that paradox and this divergent dual reality that seems to be stretching us farther and farther every day that goes by, just in the last 24 hours. And I think a significant chunk of the climate movement is making their choice, which is to let go of one side of that dual reality, to let go of the bad news. And the answer that I often get from a lot of climate movement folks and even a lot of climate scientists is that people really can't handle the truth. That you'll scare people into paralysis, that you'll push people into despair, and they'll never get up again. It was probably best articulated to me by Sarah Van Gelder, who's the editor of Yes Magazine. I was spending some time with her in Oregon a couple years ago, and we were having this conversation, and she said, well, if we tell people that it's too late to stop climate change, then what's to prevent them from abandoning all their values and giving up on the struggle for justice and just leaving as hedonistically as possible with whatever time they have left? I didn't have a particularly good answer for her at the time. All I could say was that if we don't find an answer to that question, that we're going to become increasingly irrelevant as a movement. And so answering that question has been a big focus of my work over the past couple of years. And so I've started digging deeper and thinking more into this idea that people need a sense of optimism in order to keep struggling, or people need to think that things are going to turn out okay in order to keep doing this work, in order to not slide into a completely paralyzing despair. And I realized that a lot of this comes down to our views of human nature. And there are certain assumptions that we are making about human nature when we say that people need these easy answers, people can't really handle this full truth, people can't handle that kind of paradox of a whole world that could be lost, of so much that is already being lost, and yet so much to still fight for. That's too complicated for folks. And so I thought about what it means to be pursuing this work with that kind of a view of human nature. But the question is whether what is manifesting in our current alienated and consumer-driven society is actually human nature, or whether it's something that has been imposed on our society by those who profit from an ignorant and apathetic citizenry. So if we actually hold the view that level of apathy and alienation and ignorance and seeking easy answers that we see in so much of our society, if we hold the view that that's human nature, that can't be changed, then that's deeply, deeply pessimistic for our future. That puts us on a really dark path. And that to me is actually the scariest thing to think about for our future. Because that means whatever hardships are now inevitable, people will turn to those easy answers. And that's when things get pretty scary. If we're optimistic because we think people can't handle the truth, that's just optimism as a veil for a deeper kind of hopelessness. And it's not genuine hope. That's optimism as a flimsy and fragile kind of hope. But real hope is always on the side of truth. If we are misguiding people away from the truth because we're afraid that they can't handle the truth, that is not genuinely hopeful. Genuine hope is always on the side of truth.
That was Tim DeChristopher speaking at this year's Climate Stewardship Summit in West Hartford, Connecticut. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more information on DeChristopher's Climate Disobedience Center and related issues, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. One of the most active family-owned corporations opposing action on climate change in the U.S. are Kansas billionaires Charles and David Koch, owners of Koch Industries. The Kochs have given tens of millions of dollars to political candidates and groups that deny climate science, undermine policy solutions to the problem, and attack subsidies for clean energy competition, while preserving billions of dollars in handouts to fossil fuel companies. The Koch brothers also generally promote a radical brand of free market capitalism that advocates large tax cuts for the wealthy while cutting social safety net programs for poor and working families. Largely below the radar, the Kochs in recent years have steadily increased their grants to colleges and universities across the U.S. According to a database compiled by Greenpeace, the Kochs have donated nearly $50 million to 254 universities nationwide since 2005. Those funds support conservative economic research that promote the Kochs' libertarian economic philosophy and the hiring of like-minded professors. On November 5th, a group called OnKochMyCampus.org, dedicated to exposing and challenging Koch brothers' money on campus, organized a national day of action to stop the corporatization of education. The protest, involving dozens of campuses, focused on publicizing the Kochs' influence in political agenda and higher education in advance of the 2016 election. Your reporter spoke with Kaylin Jordan, co-founder of OnKochMyCampus.org, who discusses her group's demand for transparency by college administrators on what donations their institutions are receiving from the Koch brothers and the political influence it buys.
From 2005 until 2013, there has been $68 million at over 300 campuses from the Charles Koch Foundation and other Koch foundations. And that funding has been different from campus to campus, but it has usually gone to economic departments, business departments. It's funded professorships. It's funded research think tanks. It's gone into the classroom. And what we've seen when we've been able to get information, which has been really difficult, we've seen that the influence has taken place in the classroom. The Koch Foundation said at Florida State University that they wanted final decision-making over the hiring of professors that it was funded. We're seeing a lot of influence on research coming out of Suffolk, coming out of Utah State University, that then gets funneled directly into the Koch Foundation's political network. So what we've seen is that this work on college campuses that they're doing is very methodical, and it is just the first step in the overall political machine that is what the Koch entity does.
So what is your organization asking of college administrators when you talk about Koch money that's coming into the campus or your suspicions that it is Koch money? From my understanding, you're trying to get some transparency into the process of the funding that the Koch brothers may provide, and also finding out about the strings attached and the quid pro quos that may not be so obvious to students and faculty.
Absolutely. Transparency is our number one goal. We're hoping to get transparency of any Koch donation to a university, but we're also hoping that we can help universities put in place policies that won't just apply to the Kochs. It will apply to any donor so that any student, any faculty member, any member of that university community can understand what money is coming into the university and what string is attached and what influence it's having on their campus.
So one thing that caught my eye was your National Day of Action last week on Thursday, November 5th, where dozens of college campuses participated to bring attention to the Koch brothers' money on campus. Tell us a little bit about what happened on November 5th when all these members of your organization across the country worked to bring attention to Koch brothers' money on college campuses.
It was a fantastic day. We saw a lot of unity in the student activists and faculty on college campuses. We had 50 schools participate, and the actions that they did varied from posting a picture on social media saying, I want to uncoke my campus, saying what you were concerned about on campus, to students doing banner drops and handing out flyers on campus, to campaigns kicking off their first uncoke chapter on that day. And at American University, they introduced a model policy to stop, you know, the undue influence that we've seen from the Koch brothers. So our campuses did a lot of different things, and they spoke really loudly, and we started to see people take notice, people engage in the campaign that haven't before. So it was a really, really gratifying day of action, and we had great support from Student Labor Action Project and Food and Water Watch, so other organizations that are active on campus also participated, and that unity was really felt.
Kaylin, as we conclude here, if one of our listeners wanted to find out if their college or university was receiving funding from the Koch brothers, how would they go about doing that research?
It's actually really simple. So you can just go to uncokemycampus.org, which is our website. You can go to the resources page, and on that page we have a link to our interactive database where you can find out if your university's been Koch-funded. We would really encourage anyone, whether they're a student, a faculty member, a grandparent of a student, an alumni, just a concerned citizen, to look into this, look into the university that you went to, look into the university in your hometown, and just see if it's Koch-funded. And if you want to get involved, regardless of if you're in school or out of school, I'd encourage you to reach out to us. We want to work with anybody to get transparency around this issue and get some answers.
That was Kaylin Jordan, co-founder of uncokemycampus.org. Learn more about the group's mission and related information on the Koch brothers by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.